There were two catalysts, I think is the way you say that, to our ending up leaving for Canada. The first one was the desire that the Lord placed in our hearts that, particularly in the last few years of our ministry, we might be someplace where we were really needed. And the second was missionary Tim Guerin's prayer letters that seemed to be consistently saying, we need pastors in Nova Scotia. We have churches without pastors. And finally, the Lord moved to my heart to call Brother Tim, and everything else that happened was a result of that phone call about 6 months ago. And God has been so faithful and so wonderful to lead us to a great group of people. And we just trust that God would continue to direct in our ministry to them. Bob Shelton preached at that church 2 Sundays ago, and he called me on Tuesday after he preached. He had had trouble getting home. He was in Washington, D.C. He called me from the airport to make sure that he got a hold of me before I left to go up there. And basically the conversation and his report to me was I was a very fortunate preacher to be able to pastor a church like that. And I have heartily concurred. Wonderful, friendly people. Really seem to have a heart for God. They love fellowship. You just about can't leave in time after the morning service to get back for the night service. It was literally an hour before we left last Sunday. And they don't make any pretense. After you pronounce the benediction, they just sit back down, turn to the person next to them and start talking, or the person behind, and make no pretense of leaving. They love to hear the Word of God and seem to have a heart for God. So we're looking forward to that time. And everybody says it, and I don't know how much attention you pay to it, but please remember us in prayer that God would use us. We're totally dependent upon Him. There are many reasons that we do not want to leave Greenville, and one of them, a major one, is this church. It's been an incredible blessing to us in these 4 years that we've been part of this congregation. And Jane and I will miss you. We will pray for you. We appreciate so much your fellowship, the blessing of hearing the Word taught and preached. I see Dr. Bell down here. I told my wife coming to Sunday school, I can't believe that this will be the last Sunday that I'll hear him teach. And it's always been a great blessing to me. And the music and all of these things have just, the Lord has used them in our lives. I especially appreciate the opportunity to minister. Coming to a church like this that is just full of gifted preachers and Bible teachers and staff members. It's amazing to me that God has allowed us the opportunity to minister. I never dreamed that I would be able to preach every Sunday in bus church. What a blessing that has been to me. And I just appreciate that opportunity and the opportunities, other opportunities that we've had to minister here, even driving a church bus. Even that was good. And so we appreciate all of those wonderful opportunities. The instructions for living the Christian life given to us in the New Testament are admittedly long and in some cases complex. So it is refreshing to come across occasionally summaries or what I would term Christian life capsules. A great body of truth is brought together in a single sentence or phrase. And I believe we have such a Christian life capsule here in Romans chapter 12 and verse 9. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. But a truly dramatic change would be made in the life of any believer who would put in practice this simple trilogy of instruction. First, let love be without dissimulation. Without dissimulation, of course, is one word in Greek, and it means without hypocrisy. It means pure. It means with no reservation. This is what Jesus was saying to us when he gave his famous instruction about the greatest commandment of all, when he says, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind." And you can sense in his instruction to us the purity of the love that he demands from us toward God. Pure love. Love with no hypocrisy, with no reservation, to love him totally and completely with every part of our being. My wife is a cat lover, and you would know about that just walking up the steps to our house, and you would see stone cats there by the sidewalk. And when you came into the house, you would see a whole table devoted to cat books, little statues of cats, candle holder cats. And if you were going to the kitchen, you would find a little thing on the refrigerator that says, "The sole purpose of this house is the comfort of the cat," or something to that effect. And my wife actually lives that out. And whatever the cat wants, the cat gets, is pretty much the rule of our home. The cat eats what the cat wants to eat. When we had Harris Teeter stores here, food stores, my wife and I preferred Bilo food. But the cat preferred Harris Teeter food. And so my wife went to two different grocery stores, one for us and one for the cat. I've actually seen her when the cat wasn't on its feed, she would actually put her fingers in that yucky canned cat food and hold it up to the cat, or actually put it in the microwave to get it just the right temperature to encourage the cat to eat. And my wife and I, we're a week away or 6 days away from leaving for Canada, and we're not ready yet. But Princess has been ready for about a month and a half. As soon as we knew for sure we were going, my wife went to the website, found out everything a cat has to have to get across the border, went to the vet, got the shots, got the certificates, and already she's very sensitive about the cat's feelings. And I might say to the cat, "You don't look like a princess to me. You've got long whiskers and hair in your ears. That's not like a princess." My wife will say, "Don't talk to that cat like that. You'll hurt her feelings." So we're very sensitive to the cat feelings. Now, I, on the other hand, am somewhere between a cat tolerator and a cat liker. I don't hate cats. I'm not like my brother-in-law, Nelson, who has promised Debbie that if she dies, the cat's funeral will be the same day as her funeral. I'm not like that. I don't mind reaching down and petting the cat. However, I'm at the time of life when I know that I'm going to bend down. I sort of like to plan ahead so I can do two or three different things while I'm down there. And so I don't pet the cat that much, but I don't mind doing that. One problem with petting our cat is every once in a while the cat thinks that she likes the petting and she doesn't want you to stop. And you try to walk away, and she'll get in front of your feet and keep you from moving your feet. Every time you try to take a step, she's right there to keep you from doing it. And if you persist and don't reach down and continue to pet her, she's been known to just haul off and give you a whop on the side of the leg. I mean, and I've got things to do and people to see, and I don't have time to be stumbling over a cat on the way to doing these things. So, as far as I'm concerned, the cat is fine as long as the cat does not interfere with my agenda. All that's a bunch of foolishness and means nothing, except, tragically, my attitude toward the cat is the attitude of many Christians toward our Lord. Oh, they like the Lord. And they will spend time, but don't let the Lord interfere with my agenda. I've got things to do. If I can serve the Lord on the way to doing what I really want to do, that's fine. But what a beautiful thing it is to walk into the life of a person who loves the Lord supremely. And whatever the Lord wants, the Lord gets. The life is there only for the purpose of serving the Lord. And if following the Lord means going across the street, across the state, or across the world, it makes no difference. They're concerned about the Lord's feelings, not about their own. What does the Lord want? What will cause His heart to rejoice? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. A pure love, a love without dissimulation. And then we should have a pure love for fellow believers. I'm not sure any verse in the Bible is more convicting than the one in John 13:35 that says, "By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, if you have love one for another." Those people must be Christians because they don't do certain things, do certain things, act certain ways, dress certain. No. We know they're Christians because they love each other. A pure love without dissimulation for fellow believers. And then, of course, there needs to be a pure love for a lost world that Jesus died to save. A couple years ago when Kim Crowley came to speak for the ladies' seminar here, my wife was so blessed by the messages that she gave. She got tapes of the conference, and she said, "You've got to listen to Kim Crowley's teaching." Well, time went on, and I listened to the tapes usually when I'm driving someplace, and we didn't go anyplace. But finally, I was asked to speak up in East Tennessee, and I remember driving up there, and I put in Kim Crowley's tape, and she was talking about this pure love for the unsaved, and she was talking about the privacy issue on the field where they're ministering. Some of you, I'm sure most of you remember her relating that. And basically, in the area in which they live, there is no such thing as privacy. And she told about being in her kitchen and hearing somebody giving a tour of her house in another room. And then one time, when it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, she heard her baby crying and came out of her bedroom where she'd been taking a nap, went into the baby's room, and there was a woman with not a great reputation, if you know what I mean, pinching her baby. Well, she had to come apart. And so that night she got her husband, and they sat down, and she said, "We have to do something. I can't live like this." And so they talked together, and I think the upshot was that maybe there's some adjustments that need to be made in some areas, but the basic thing, as they begin to discuss this together, was the fact that God has brought us here to Cambodia to model a Christian life in front of these godless people. And we can't do that if we isolate ourselves. And we have to be willing to lay our lives down beside their lives, so to speak, so they can see what Christianity is about. And we should love them with no reservation. And we should be willing for them to come into our lives and to see where we are and for us to invest ourselves, even to the extent of our privacy, to invest ourselves in their lives. I'd heard that before, and I'm saying amen. There's something comforting about hearing what missionaries need to do on the other side of the world. But unfortunately, she didn't, for my temporary peace of mind, she didn't leave it there. And she said, "You know, this started when I lived in the United States." She said, "My life was sort of like this. I sort of pulled into my life all of those who were like me, graduated from a Christian college, had their children in Christian schools, listened to the same music that I listened to, and I just sort of brought them in and then built a wall around my life. Now, she said, there would be times when I would venture out. I would open the gates to my life. I would walk across the moat and go out there, and I would minister in the bus ministry, or I would go on visitation. But as soon as that activity was over, I would run back into my castle and close the doors and be surrounded only by people just like myself. And I said, ouch. That's just the way I was living. Not willing to open myself and express love to those who were unsaved. Let love be without dissimulation. Then he says, abhor that which is evil. In other words, you need to do some hating. Now, hating is not politically correct today. And you've all seen the word hate and then surrounded by a circle with a slash through it. They put them on bumper stickers. And the idea is that you're supposed to accept everything. And I would suggest that this is one of Satan's most successful lies today. That we just need to accept everything and not hate anything. And I would submit this evening that you're never going to be successful in your Christian life until you learn to hate. Psalm 45:7, speaking of Jesus, says, thou lovest righteousness and hateth iniquity. Psalm 97:10 says, ye that love the Lord, hate evil. Now that happens to be a command. Ye that love the Lord, hate evil. Amos chapter 5 and verse 15, hate the evil and love the good. Proverbs 8:12, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. And you can compare that to Romans 3:18, which says there is no fear of God before their eyes. And I think the implication is there that we do not totally love the Lord and we do not fear the Lord because we have not learned to hate, or we're tied up in this business of not looking out to the world like God looks at it and hating those things that are evil. I wonder sometime if children are not most influenced by what their parents hate rather than what their parents love. I remember my dad hated alcohol. And I can remember as we would be taking trips. Now, this was the days before fast food, and finding a place to eat was a major item on a trip with a family. And you couldn't go to the internet and look ahead and know what restaurants were down the road because there wasn't any such thing. And I can remember being in the car, there's five children and mom and dad, and we'd be heading down the road and we'd be hungry. And we'd say, Daddy, we're hungry. He'd say, well, we'll see if we can find something. And we'd drive and drive and drive, no restaurant. Daddy, we're hungry. We'll find something. And we'd drive and drive and drive, and we'd be hungrier and hungrier, and we'd be fussy, and we'd keep driving. Finally, way up the road, somebody would spy a sign that said, restaurant. Oh, we'd be so excited, we're about to get something to eat. And so we'd come along there, and my dad would start to slow down. And as he slowed down, he'd look, and there'd be a beer sign in the window. Accelerator down, off we'd go. Daddy, we're hungry. We're not eating there. I can actually remember going into restaurants. No sign that they sold alcohol. Opening a menu, seeing alcohol there. My dad had folded his menu and said, the waitress, I appreciate your consideration, but we've decided not to eat here today, and all seven of us would walk out. My dad hated alcohol. And, you know, I guess I've been tempted to do about every rotten thing anybody's ever been tempted to do except drink. Never even been tempted. I was with my grandchildren in Charlotte one time, and they had a new video the television in their house is up in their mom and dad's bedroom, and that's where, so the mom and dad can control what they see. But anyway, they sent us up there with this video, and I was going up with the grandkids to watch this video. I think it was the Jetsons. And so we plugged that thing in, and we're going along and watching this comedy thing, cartoon affair. And as we're watching, all of a sudden, somebody on the cartoon grabs a guitar and starts flinging that thing or whatever they do. And all of a sudden, the music coming at it was not acceptable. And I hate to admit it, but I sort of dithered there for a minute. I'm thinking, well, maybe this should just last a few seconds. You know how you think that? Well, maybe it's not that bad. And while I'm dithering, my 8-year-old grandson, Benjamin, just grabs the remote and hits the mute. He looks up at me and he says, I don't think we ought to listen to that, Grandpa, do you? And about the time he said that, I looked down at my Brycey, I think was 4 at the time. Brycey's sitting cross-legged on the carpet. He's got his hands on his knees, and he looks up at me, and he screws up his face in as horrible expression as he can get. He says, my mommy hates that kind of music. She really hates it. And I thought, you know, Brycey's religious education is not complete yet. It'll be complete when he understands that we hate things because God hates them. But in the meantime, until his attitude of who God is and understanding of God can be formed, that's not a bad substitute. Psalm 119, verse 104. Through thy precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. We hate false religion and false teaching. Big discussion today in evangelical circles. Is it wrong to hate Islam? The only question we need to ask is Islam a false religion? If it's false, then it is to be hated. Revelation 2 and verse 6 says, thou hatest the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Jude chapter 23, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. There's a passage over in Psalms that we use often. It's a very familiar passage. In fact, we have a song based on this passage that we sing. It's search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. I wonder if you've ever noticed the context for that prayer. Let me read the preceding 2 verses. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. Would he not be saying in the context, Lord, check out my hatred? Do I hate like I ought to hate? Let love be without dissimulation. Pure love. Abhor that which is evil. And then cleave to that which is good. The word cleave means to be joined to be attached to be one with, to embrace tightly. Cleave to that which is good. Be joined to it, attached to it, be one with it, embrace it tightly. I was a sophomore at Bob Jones University. One summer I was on an evangelistic team, and among other places we held an evangelistic meeting in South Tunnel, Tennessee. That's up north of Gallatin, which in itself is north of Nashville. And it's named South Tunnel because there are 2 train tunnels close to where the little community is. But the tunnels are out in the woods. So 3 of us in the evangelistic party decided we want to go out and see these train tunnels. People told us, you go to this little thing here and you head out through the woods and you'll probably find them. So sure enough, we went out and found the train tunnels. And we happened to come down the embankment right between the 2 tunnels. Both of them were on a long curve, which means that you couldn't see the end of the tunnel from the center. You could just look into the tunnel on this way, and it went in a big curve, and this one also. So we looked at the tunnels, and we decided we'd explore this tunnel that went on this side. And it was just the ties were down in the bottom, and the rail, of course. And then at the end of the ties was a section probably about that wide, maybe something like that. And it was cut down further, and there was a little bit of water that was running down in that little drainage thing at the end of the ties. And then the walls of the tunnel were just blasted out, and they were rough walls. So we put our ear down the track to make sure that there was no train coming, and we started through the tunnel. We got to the other end of the tunnel, and amazingly, the only thing to see at the other end of the tunnel was the other end of the tunnel. So we put our ear down the track, make sure no train was coming, and started back through the tunnel to our original place that we'd come in. And we got about halfway through the tunnel. Still couldn't see either end at that point of the tunnel. And all three of us all of a sudden stopped because we thought we heard something. And then we didn't hear anything. So we started to walk on. We took about three or four steps, and all of a sudden, we knew we had heard something. And it was a train whistle. So we went flying down this direction to get out of that tunnel before the train came in. And we were running just as fast as we could go. And it seemed like, I can still remember, it's almost like we all sort of decided at the same time, we shouldn't be running between the ties. We might trip and fall down here, and the train would go over. So we all sort of jumped out like little rabbits, you know, over. We went into that little narrow ditch type affair beside the end of the ties. And we were just running like everything. And we were probably 75 yards from the mouth of the tunnel, which by this time was in sight, when all of a sudden the whole mouth of the tunnel was filled with locomotive. You say, Pastor Doug, what did you do? Well, I began to cleave to the walls of the tunnel. I mean, I melted myself and poured myself in to every tiny little crack and crevice in that tunnel. I began to cleave to the walls of the tunnel. God says, I want you to cleave to that which is good. Is this good? Grab onto it. Hold it. Embrace it with your heart. Give yourself over to it. Is prayer good? Embrace it. Cleave to it. Hold on to it. Make yourself one with it. Is this church good? Then cleave to it. Embrace it. Hold on to it. So many people have tried to analyze the success of this great church. How did it happen? And I'm not an expert. And what I'm about to say is in no way to minimize the wonderful leadership that God has given this church over the years, and the staff members, and Pastor Yerrick, and so forth. But if I were forced to say what it is that has caused this church to be so successful, I would say it was because between 20 and 35 years ago, a couple hundred couples decided this church was something good. It was worth cleaving to. They were young, full of energy, themselves 25 to 40 years of age. And I can remember visiting this church when they met down in the Collins. There was a sense of excitement. These couples felt that they had found something that was good. It was worth pouring themselves into. It was worth holding up and holding on and carrying forward and dreaming dreams about. And you could sense it when you walked into the room. When you sat in the Sunday school class, they thought it was the greatest Sunday school class on the continent. They loved everything about the church. And so many of them are still here. still cleaving. But it's time for a new generation of cleavers. What a beautiful thing it is to me to see that some of that's already happening. I love walking down the halls and seeing the Ladies for Missions table with the young ladies there. What a beautiful thing it is as I minister in the bus church and see the young people whose heart has melted into this church and who love this church. I see our young deacon chairman, and I say that advisedly. All people look young to me now. But it's such a thrill to me to see so many that are now taking the place and moving beside and cleaving, holding this church in their hearts. But we need a couple hundred more. We need some of you to come out of the shadows. Quit being carried and jump down here and grab it and help carry it yourself. This church needs to be taken past this $1 million for missions, and we need to be working on that second million. We need to go to a new level. And I believe it will happen because people say, this church is a good thing. I'm going to cleave to it. I'm going to hold on to it. I'm going to lift it up. I'm going to dream dreams. I have a passion for what God is doing in this place. And who knows what could be done. What a beautiful thing has already been done. While we've been going through this Sunday, probably tens of thousands of people represented by those letters out there on the wall have heard the gospel because somebody thought it's worth cleaving to this thing which is good. May God help more to join. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. And then just one other word briefly. Like the Christian life, salvation itself is vastly complex in its ramifications. But at the same time, so simple, only childlike faith can access it. It was, I suppose, a year and a half ago now. My wife and I got the phone call, that special phone call that all grandparents look forward to. And our daughter from Charlotte got us on the phone. We knew what was coming up because she had told us last time we were together. She said, I think Braden is about to get saved. So when we got the phone call, she said, Braden wants to talk to you. Some of you remember my grandson Braden. He was the ring bearer in Ryan and Elizabeth's wedding, and he stood right there. And during the ceremony, he dropped the ring pillow not once but twice. And when the wedding was over, his parents were relieved that he didn't do anything else. But that's Braden. And he told us Grandma and Grandpa got saved, and we told him how wonderful that was, and then. Melody, our daughter, got on the line to fill us in a little bit more of the details. It seems that the Sunday before, she had been teaching the Sunday school class that Braden was in, and she had used that old story that is used so many times with the children about the hen with the chicks who was out in the field and all of a sudden realized that a prairie fire was coming and the field was on fire. There was no way that she could get all of her chicks and get them back to safety. She could go herself, but she couldn't take the chicks with her. So, as the story goes, she gathered the chicks, spread her wings out over them, and crouched down over the little baby chicks. The fire came and swept over and killed her, but the little chicks were saved because they were underneath her wings. Melody notices Braden listened to the story that he began to cry. And he was just crying through the whole story. So on the way home from church, she said, Braden, why were you crying during Sunday school? He said, Mommy, I was so sad that mother hen had to die. And so Jerry and Melody explained again that it was a picture of the fact that Jesus died to save us. And they said, "Do you understand that?" And he said, "Yes, I understand." But they didn't press it. They wanted to make sure that it was of him and not something that they were imposing. So several days later, they were going through the go-to-bed ritual, and all families have these, and you get your baths here, and you get your drinks here, and then you go for your devotions, and that's the way they do it. And Jerry teaches them all right there. He gets down on one knee in front of the couch and puts them all up there and teaches them the Bible story, and they take prayer requests and give answers for, you know, that whole routine. And since there are five children in that family, and the oldest is nine, you can imagine there's always been a baby in the family. And so the standard go-to-bed procedure would be done with the older ones, and then there was something special for the baby. So they'd get the older ones and get them in bed after their procedure, and then they would go get the baby and get the baby ready for bed. And one of the things that they would do for the baby is to sit down in the rocking chair, hold the baby, and they would sing. And they always sang that song, "Oh, How He Loves You and Me." That was their standard lullaby, if you please. So on this particular evening, after the older boys were in bed and Melody had sung to the baby, she was walking back out past the bedroom where the older boys were, and she could see that Braden was still awake. And she said, "Braden, why are you still awake, son?" "I'm not sleepy, Mommy." "Well, you need to go to sleep." "Mommy?" "Yes." "Why don't you ever sing to me anymore?" And she said, "Braden, I'll sing to you." And so she sat down outside the bedroom, got him in her lap. Here's this five-year-old boy sitting in her lap. And she begins to sing, "Oh, how he loves you and me. Oh, how he loves you and me. He gave his life. What more could he give? Oh, how he loves you. Oh, how he loves me. Oh, how he loves you and me. Jesus to Calvary did go, his love for mankind to show. What he did there brought hope from despair. Oh, how he loves you. Oh, how he loves me. Oh, how he loves you and me." As she was singing to him, she felt his arms tighten around her waist, and he began to cry again. She said, "Braden, why are you crying, son?" He said, "Mommy, I'm so sad that Jesus had to die." She said, "You want to receive the gift that he paid for when he died?" "Yes, Mommy." She said, "Let's go down and talk to Daddy." And he went down and received Christ as his Savior. You say, "Pastor Dodd, could it possibly be that simple?" It is. It's just that simple.